I'm going to pour us some wine. How about that?
Is it wine that I will enjoy?
No. No, it's not.
I've tried it in several glasses. I've tried it in different temperatures. I kind of think I like it more room temp than chilled, even though you said the preferred presentation
is
chilled. I do not like it here or there. I do not like it anywhere.
Scotty, don't like this wine.
I do not like it anywhere.
Scotty, don't.
So I was doing a Dr. Seuss thing. And then
I was doing an Austin Powers thing.
You had to do an Austin Powers thing. My thing was better.
Your thing was better.
My thing was classier, more timeless.
So we've established that Scott Adam Hudson does not like sherry.
Mm. Oh my God.
He hates it.
Oh.
I love it.
Ugh. Let's just do it. Let's just do it. Let's just dive right in. Start the show. You're all full of piss and vinegar about this movie. I'm all hot and bothered because this wine is gross and because this movie's good. Let's just do it.
We're doing it.
We've
got it. All right.
But joyously.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, theys and thems, welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy.
We are pairing wine with movies, hopefully exploring / mining for / manifesting synesthesia between the two of them. And I think that there's a fair bit in this particular podcast.
In this episode?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Spoilers on my take
okay.
on the pairing.
Yeah.
I think there's a bit.
It's a temporal podcast movement. Past Jamie is moving forward, backward. Future Jamie moving backward towards the intro.
He's doing a bad job with this one.
It's complicated.
It's a stupid fucking movie.
It's pretty good.
I think
it's great.
It's a dumb, stupid, bad movie. No, it's not bad. It's dumb and stupid, though.
It is neither of those things. Well, it's a little dumb, but it's not stupid.
I fucking hate it. Anyway, today we're talking about Tenet. We're very, very sorry. On the last episode, we teased that we were going to do She Dies Tomorrow, paired with Chateau Vieille Mataran, 100%
Indeed.
To not. But...
Surprise!
This is mostly due to sort of an impromptu viewing that Scott and I had, and also I'm having a bit of a mental health thing the past couple of weeks, and She Dies Tomorrow is super heavy, or so Scott says, and I wasn't, like, emotionally prepared for that.
Sure. I mean, we could use the real reason. I was going to give you a cover and say that I initially, when coming up with the schedule for the episodes, wanted Tenet to go last because Tenet would have been like roughly like a July 4th episode drop for us.
Right.
And like, it's like, it, not that it was a July 4th movie. It wasn't even a July movie. It ended up being like a September movie in the US last year. But Chris Nolan's a big June, July guy. And like summer movies, people are going back to the movies. It's 2021. It's hot, unmasked, vax summer. And people are going to the movies, except me. And it really hurts. And I want to go. And I just can't. So anyway, we could have used that reason.
We could have, but no, the real thing is, you know, it's hard out here, and
yeah.
we all have our mental health that we deal with, and I'm glad that we had this to pivot, because
yeah.
I feel like She Dies Tomorrow might have done some bad things.
It still probably will.
Anyway,
yeah,
we're in person today again.
We are.
Scott seems less uncomfortable today.
Well, I'm getting used to people and eye contact. I'm working my way into it.
Tell us about the movie.
Tenet is the latest from Christopher Nolan, famed writer, director, auteur of, among other things, Memento, The Dark Knight Trilogy, Inception, and Dunkirk. So you, the audience, can already guess that it is a slick, propulsive, aggressive, high-class actioner that's, like, really immaculately designed, and it's inventive, and it's also laden with constant technical exposition that is delivered by a cast of gorgeous and extremely talented actors, and it is constructed in some kind of like temporarily fucked puzzle box of a plot. I think it's great. Your mileage may vary. Jamie's mileage was pretty lackluster. Or maybe the movie's mileage with Jamie was pretty lackluster. I digress.
I was mad.
What I told James to prepare him for this film and for
my
this
name
pairing,
isn't James, it's Jamie.
His name is James.
I told you
that Tenet was inscrutable. Lush, deceptively shallow, or possibly deceptively deep. It is a pulp master's piece, and that it is loud. And I believe all of those things to be true.
I don't really find this movie to be lush.
Let's set up the wine, and then let's just get into it, because we got to get into it.
We got to get into
all right.
it, because right. we disagree so much about everything.
About literally everything that we're about to discuss. That's great.
Except that we agree on the things, just the conclusion is... Anyway, the wine that I chose that Scott hates is Valdespino's Inocente Fino. So this is sherry coming from Jerez de la Frontera in Spain. This is southern Spain. It's very hot climate. It's 100% Palomino coming from the Macanudo vineyard, which we will get into when I start giving you some of the technical details about the wine. I think that there are very few people out there who would disagree with a general assessment of sherry as being inscrutable. Sherry is kind of difficult to understand, and it's also difficult to parse what you're tasting when you taste it. I think it is both deceptively shallow and deceptively deep. If you can allow yourself to get pulled in by this wine and like really think about vineyard sources and like the ways that it's made and all of that shit. But also, it's very easy to just, for me anyway, obviously not for Scott, to just down a whole bottle on a summer day with some fancy ham or some tinned fish.
I did not have any fancy ham or any tinned fish to go along with this. Today I tried it with Parmesan and an assortment of more savory cheeses and crackers.
Parm would be a good pair.
Parm, my wife thought, would actually like help open up some of those flavors in there, and I did not find that to be the case. The only thing that made me like it even a little bit was warmth. Chilled, I didn't like it. Even room temp, I didn't like it. By the time I had like the last of a glass out by the pool, I found it like, oh, this is, now it finally tastes like what it smells like. And what it smells like, I'm on board with. And what it tastes like, I am not on board with.
I very much prefer it like with a little chill on it. I like it at around 60 degrees, 55 to 60. The one thing that I noted in the pairing sheet is that this wine is definitely, I would not call this wine lush. It's like kind of purposefully the opposite of lush. And I think in that way actually pairs very well with the movie because, as I said, I don't think that the movie is lush. And we'll get into it. We're about to talk about the movie.
Let's talk about Let's talk about Tenet.
Scott's hair is like lighting on fire from me saying that.
Well, I just don't think.
He's mad.
At least one of us doesn't know what the word lush means, I think is the problem. But let's just preface it for the audience.
Hold on. Huh? I didn't get through the pairing words.
I thought
words.
You were done moving through it. All right.
You're just getting...
You said
we're about
to talk about the movie.
You're putting the cart before the horse.
Wow.
All right? Just relax. Or maybe. Over there.
Or maybe the horse is supposed to come before the cart.
God. Mother. Anyway. A Pulp Masters piece. This wine is possibly the best representation of sherry as a whole.
Really?
And I would describe it as a masterpiece. Comes from the best vineyard source. It is produced by one of the oldest sherry houses and just has a really storied history. It's also pretty fucking loud. There's a lot of... There are many flavors going on here and none of them are particularly quiet. Now, let's go into the movie there, Scott.
I will warn all peoples... Before I even do a plot synopsis, spoilers. There be spoilers. You can barely have a conversation about what happens in the movie, but you really can't have a conversation about what happens in it without, like, spoiling everything. So spoilers abound, starting right now. John David Washington plays the protagonist, heretofore referred to as the protagonist. The protagonist is a badass American spy recruited into a secret global organization called Tenet to fight back against the forces of the future who are using entropy-reversing technology to try and take over our time.
Okay, I want to stop you briefly here.
Why do you always have to stop me during the synopsis?
Because it's fun, first of all, and second of all, because you're talking the whole time and I want to hear my own voice.
It's one paragraph.
Okay, finish then.
I had like a whole flow built up. Not even. Kenneth Branagh plays our villain, Sator, a wealthy, like, billionaire arms dealer and a contemporary broker for the future. Elizabeth Debicki plays Sator's estranged wife, Kat. She is held somewhat hostage by him to protect their son. And Robert Pattinson plays Neil, a British intelligence officer who aids the protagonist in executing a series of elaborate heists and spectacular set piece against Sator's entropy-reversed, moving backwards in time forces. It's a lot. It's a Bond movie with a big sci-fi idea crammed right in the middle of it. And it's all of Chris Nolan's weird idiosyncratic obsessions. And it's the most Chris Nolan movie.
Crammed, by the way, is a perfect...
It's stuffed. The movie is stuffed.
But crammed is the, like hastily crammed.
I don't think it's hasty at all.
The sci-fi of it all. It feels at once well thought out and also slapdash.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Let's just hear your take. So for the audience's purposes, what you're about to hear is right after our viewing in my home theater a few days ago. Jamie was all hot and bothered and sweaty and pissed off about the movie.
I was not sweaty.
He was pretty sweaty. So I just put a microphone in front of his face and he just like yelled for 20 minutes. So here maybe are like the most cogent parts of that. You guys should listen to Jamie's hottest of takes. And then present day Scott and Jamie will see you guys in a few moments and we'll see if Jamie's take has softened at all.
So we're literally 15 minutes out from having finished the movie.
Way less than that.
Maybe 10 minutes. And I cannot possibly verbalize how annoyed I am by this fucking film. Holy shit. Christopher Nolan, what is the view like from inside your own ass? This movie was so purposefully obtuse. I thought that the peak was Inception of purposeful obtuseness. Tenet goes like far and beyond and presents itself as a thing that is telling you like a deeper truth. And there's no fucking substance at all. The performances are spectacular. All of the actors fucking kill it.
Even Kenneth Branagh.
Even fucking Kenneth Branagh.
Even Moose and Squirrel.
With his cartoon Russian accent.
It's still a good performance.
It's a great performance. It's a really great performance. And Robert Pattinson blew me the fuck away. And visually, it is arresting. But there is almost nothing under the surface that I can discern. And I'm pissed off by the attitude that there is something deeper. Every line reading is like Morpheus in The Matrix. It's just anytime this movie takes a moment to explain itself. Which is 40% of the movie, right. It takes so long trying to explain itself. It does it badly, and then sometimes it does it with deliberately garbled audio, which would lead you to believe that the explanation doesn't matter, except it takes up so fucking much of the runtime of the fucking movie. Oh. Sorry, I'm peeking.
Yeah, your levels are real hot.
Basically, the long and the short of it, kids, is that I hated this movie. I can't imagine. I'm so shocked that Scott likes this movie. All of my intellectual problems with this movie aside, like I just didn't enjoy watching it because it never fucking brought me in. It never made me feel included. It made me feel like all of this shit is just happening. And if I don't get it, then I'm not smart enough. And I know that I'm fucking smart enough. And for me to feel so confused by the end of it is bad fucking storytelling. It's a bad story poorly told. And that's what I got for you, kids.
All right, so your take is softened because you were outraged.
I was outraged.
You were incensed.
Partly because I've got beef with Nolan.
Right. Which isn't fair.
It's not fair.
It's kind of fair, but you also skipped out. You haven't seen his last three or four movies.
Yeah, and I also haven't seen the best of the movies by all accounts, right? Like, I haven't seen The Prestige.
I guess you've seen probably, what, like six of
his
movies?
I've seen all of the Batmans. I've seen Insomnia. I've seen Inception. And I've seen this.
Yeah.
Scott said it very, very well before. This is a very Christopher Nolan movie, yeah. Possibly the most Christopher Nolan movie.
It's funny. I was so excited to see this movie because my own like journey with the guy's career and the guy's arc, like you basically stopped with Nolan around the point where like my relationship to his body of work soured. Dark Knight drove me crazy. Like the hype on that was redonkulous.
Yep.
And the backlash for me started in the parking lot. After the movie.
I was there with you.
Yeah. I remember our friend, Kid Turtlepuss, KTP.
Friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod, KTP. He walked out of the theater on opening night and he was like gasping. And he's like, I feel like I just had great sex. That's my spot on KTP impression, by the way. He's a professional voice actor.
Exactly.
He'll be really
what
impressed.
He sounds like.
Oh my God, I just had sex from that movie. That's what he sounded like. And I told him to calm down. And like that was the beginning. And I was that guy. I was that guy who was like the backlash to the thing that's just begun. I was terrible.
Which very frequently it's a thing that I do often.
Right.
And it's a thing that you did a lot more in the past than you do now.
And now I'm less interested in what other people think, and I try not to backlash because it's not fucking healthy. And I had a weird, unhealthy relationship with that movie that I didn't like, where, like, for the next 6 or 7 years, I would watch it at least once a year because I was so fascinated by it. Because that movie's legacy looms large. Like, it's enormous, does, yeah. And it is a beloved movie.
And I should watch it again just to give it a... Every time I've seen it, I've been annoyed by it.
But so, like, the things that drove me crazy about Dark Knight are the things that drove me crazy about all of Nolan's movies since then, right? So, like, in that movie, to a lesser extent than what's in Batman Begins, but, like, the action is at times incomprehensible. The fight scenes are just, like, all fucking medium shots of people all in black clothes.
And you can't understand what is happening. And that is one thing that I'll give Tenet. You understand,
yeah.
At the very least, the geography of what is happening,
yeah.
In any scene, including the scenes where, like, one person is moving forward in time and another person is moving backward in time. That is stunningly well communicated.
Yeah.
It's kind of a technical and creative marvel.
Yeah.
I'm not, for the record, saying that this movie is bad.
Okay. But you hate it.
I hate it.
Okay. I can roll with that. But so, like, all the knocks against him, like the clunky and janky and draining and exhausting pacing and, like, dialogues where characters are exclusively either explaining the plot, their own motivations, or their symbolic purpose in the movie.
I fucking hate that shit.
It drove me nuts. And then Inception was basically the same thing, where it's like 2 hours
to 11
of exposition just so that you can have that last half an hour where basically everybody shuts up and you can just, like, watch all the amazing mechanics, like, finally paying off. And then Interstellar was more the same. I was mad in the theater about that one. And then beautiful, magical Dunkirk comes along. And Dunkirk is this, like, it's the purest distillation of a Chris Nolan movie. It is everything that he's great at is the best he's ever expressed it. And it has none of his weaknesses. There is almost no verbal exposition in Dunkirk. There's very little dialogue. The action is all immaculately constructed. And his obsession with time, which so often is the thing that people obsess about with his movies, like, it's this fascination with him, right? It's like Spielberg with divorce. But, like, Dunkirk, the time thing is thematically important. And it crystallizes in this one moment late in the movie where all of those three timelines come together in this one beautiful moment that is, like, thrilling and heroic and horrifying. And it's the crystallization of everything he was trying to do. And it's this beautiful expression of, like, why his brain works this way about time. Like what it is that we can say about how people interact with each other and about relationships and about causality that affects the human experience. Like, it's this profound moment. And he does it in a movie where he doesn't lean on dialogue.
So watching this movie for you was like a turnkey on his on, like, understanding what he does,
yes,
or on appreciating,
yes,
what he does?
Both. Part of it is that Dunkirk is, like, a great turning point movie in his career, and I was able to tap into it. And then when I went back and looked at his other movies, I could appreciate them more. But part of it was just the timing for me. Like, by the time Dunkirk came out, I'd seen, you know, several hundred more movies than since I had last been mad at Chris Nolan. And my accumulated understanding of the medium and the variety of different things you can do with the medium had broadened to a point where I was like, I can accept this guy for what he is. I can accept that this guy is a master of making his types of movies, and that the good that he is able to accomplish, like, he's such a rarity. Like, you have to appreciate him and value him in today's, like, Marvelized world where everything is CGI, green screens, and, you know,
yes,
IP-driven backdrops. Like, he has a specific idiosyncratic voice. He has these unique obsessions and themes that run throughout his work. He's great at casting. He's great at creating suspense and world building. His scripts have these, like, big brain sci-fi concepts, and they're packaged in familiar genres and tropes. His shit is classy. There's a prestige-y quality to it. It never looks cheap, and it never looks fake. It always looks real. Like, his obsession with...
Well, I mean, in fairness, it never is cheap.
No, but look, this weekend or today, Fast 9 is opening up, and that is a movie that cost more than Tenet and will not look as good as Tenet, because he doesn't just, like, we'll just, you know, throw some CG in there. Like, there's never any shitty CG scenes in a Chris Nolan movie. It's
get
all
it
just
in
happening
camera
in front of you. But that's great. Like, you feel it.
I
it's
agree.
Palpable. You
I
feel
agree.
It. I think his failings at this point, I just have to accept as features and not bugs. Like, yes, he leans too hard on exposition. Yes, his characters are paper thin, and his female characters are even more paper thin. His movies are really cold emotionally, and they're sexless. But, like, that's, like, part of him. You know, that's like part of his deal. And I think if suddenly Chris Nolan became able to like tell like a rich emotional story with like nuanced and like lived in characters and was able to express things about like sexuality or femininity or just the human condition more than what he does, like he might lose the other things that he can do. I don't know. Like, I don't want him to be another filmmaker at this point. I want him to keep doing the shit that he does, because when he's on fire, which is not always, but like when he delivers, his shit can be transcendent. There is stuff in Dunkirk that I find to be transcendent. There's a lot in this movie that I think is genuinely like it. I don't know, man. This is what I asked you the other day off mic when we were watching it. Like, isn't it thrilling to have a movie that breaks your brain? And not like, oh, like the twists and the reveals, but like there is shit in Tenet that I look at the screen and my brain literally cannot comprehend what it's processing. And I feel like I have to be smarter to keep up with it. And I find that so exciting. And that never fucking happens in action movies.
Yeah, I'll give you that. So we, sometime last week at this point, we said we were going to talk about my takes. And then you went on a
Well,
on
we
a
heard
whole
your
thing.
Your past takes, and now let's hear your present.
So
day
here's
takes. You've softened.
I've softened, and you described pretty perfectly and accurately why I don't like this movie.
Yeah.
I come to fiction for rich lived-in characters.
Right.
I don't care that much about plot as long as there are people in the world that I can connect with.
Yeah.
Like one of my favorite books ever is A Confederacy of Dunces, which has no plot. Nothing happens. But Ignatius J. Reilly is one of the most rich characters ever put on paper. That for me is the reason that I engage with fiction. I fundamentally don't care about an exploration of a sci-fi concept that doesn't also talk about its effect on people.
But it does. This movie does, though. And
I disagree that it uses the sci-fi concept to talk about people. This movie is better at talking about people and expressing people than any other Nolan film I've seen. Part of that is to do with Arpatz's performance. Like him and Washington have honest to God chemistry.
They have amazing chemistry.
In a way that I have really not seen on camera in a Nolan film.
Look, the strike against him that his characters are ostensibly very thin is, I think, a fair strike, especially since most of what he gives them to say in dialogue, which he is so dependent upon, like he puts dialogue so much to the foreground, even if he doesn't care if you can understand it or not.
Which is the next thing.
The characterization in this movie, like, yes, everybody is just a vessel for exposition, but the characters themselves are much richer, I think, than you're giving them credit for. But specifically, your strike that they don't talk about how, or the movie's not about how, the big sci-fi concept reflects the human condition. Like, look at your villain. Sator, we find out in flashbacks, he was a young man when there was this, like, atomic or nuclear accident in the town where he lived. And basically, you find out that the future selected him almost at random because he was doing cleanup in this atomic area. And they realized that they could use places where there were nuclear spills or accidents to mask the radiation of the inversion machines, the turnstiles to send things back to him, whatever, that doesn't matter. But what matters is like the guy's entire life and his destiny was written out for him in this one day when he's a young man. He opens this crate and there's like a bunch of gold inside and a fucking like laminated piece of paper that's been sent back to him from hundreds of years in the future saying like, Mr. Sator, you will work for us and we'll make you extremely wealthy. And then that just changes everything for him. Now this guy has, like, terminal pancreatic cancer. Like, not only is he a sociopath and a warped, depraved person, but he sees the future's reasoning for wanting to wage their war on us, on their past, and embraces it. And he's incredibly fatalistic, and I think a huge part of that is because of how the whole future was laid out to him at, like, this impressionable moment in his young life.
And I'll give you this, I just thought about it. The one way that it really does directly affect characters and their interactions with one another is the reveal in Oslo when the protagonist figures out that Neil,
yeah,
Robert Pattinson, saw his backward self.
Right, in the turnstile.
In the turnstile and didn't tell him.
Right.
And then the line gets said like 15 or 20 times after that.
It's a number
of
times.
That secrecy is our greatest weapon or some
right.
shit.
Ignorance is our weapon. It's standard operating procedure.
Standard operating procedure. That's right.
You got so mad when they said standard operating procedure.
It's fucking annoying.
Heaven forbid a tight-knit, past-future, global spy organization have an SOP, Jamie. Yeah, you're going to begrudge them having an SOP?
Super fucking tight-knit when no one knows who's leading what.
Yeah, I mean, that's all pretty cool.
Everyone is taking orders from question mark.
when the protagonist, after like tying up the last of the loose ends at the very end of the movie, and he was like, I just realized that I'm not working for you. You and I have both been working for me. I was just like, I cheered. It's such an absurd.
And I was so annoyed by it.
I love it.
I'm still
so
annoyed by it. And I was talking today with a potential client for my consulting business about meeting people where they are. And I think that this is the argument that you're trying to make. If you meet this movie and Christopher Nolan where he is,
yeah,
you're going to enjoy it more. And on my second viewing, I tried. I did. And I did enjoy it more.
Excellent.
But I fundamentally don't like the place that he is.
I think that's reasonable.
I
think that's fair.
I like characters and I like fun. And I don't think that this movie.
You don't think his movies are fun?
I don't think any of them are fun.
I
like whimsy, and these are like purposefully devoid of whimsy.
Well, yeah, he's not a whimsical person. Christopher Nolan does not have a whimsical bone in his body.
Yeah.
But I don't want to just talk about characters the whole time, but like that drives me crazy that you don't think that the sci-fi conceit is tied into the characters. You love the character of Neil. That guy's entire.
He's the only one that
characterization
I like.
Who is explicitly tied into how the inversion technology changes the human condition. I think we're meant to infer by the end that like he and the protagonist, or the protagonist, are best friends, right? Like they're work bros for life.
Yes.
The protagonist, brand new to Tenet, is recruiting Neil, even though Neil has been a member of Tenet for a while. We find out that the protagonist recruited him years ago. And then for Neil, he is straight up facing his own mortality. Like, by the end of the movie, he doesn't know that he's going to die when he goes back in to rescue them, but he gets a pretty strong sense of it. And I just don't know how you can't see that the concept is a part of the characterization for all of them. Kat's whole arc is defined by her being envious, a woman who is jumping off jumping off the deck of Sator's yacht.
It's freedom. And it ends up being her.
And it ends up being her. Like, you could have seen that coming a mile away. I know I did in the theater, but the character's arc and all of her characterization is all leading up to that moment. And it wouldn't happen without inversion. It's not just plot. It's important to the character.
She would have had a bend towards wanted freedom regardless. Like, her whole character is freedom regardless of the inversion technology.
Well, it's...
And Sator's whole thing is about power, and it would be that with or without the inversion technology.
No,
the protagonist is about doing the right thing, I guess.
I mean, he's pretty slim. He doesn't even get a fucking name.
Even when he is pulled out of his world and into this world, he fundamentally does not change.
And isn't that interesting? He's a rock. He is challenged. He is pushed to try and break out of his comfort zone, out of the principles and the tenets that he wants to stand on. And he largely is able to hold to them, despite everybody else around him trying to tell him to be cynical or telling him to be more jaded or more like callous and in the way that he deals with things in the international, interchronal time agent sphere.
It feels like you're reading more into it than is there.
No, I think it's all there.
I don't see it. I for sure don't see it. And I think that the protagonist's solidity, his rock solidness, is very much the same as the other characters. Like I said, Kat doesn't change. Like, she sees a symbol of freedom as a result of inversion, but she's not changed by it. She wanted that before. She was bothered by her captivity and by her inability to mother her child.
But the inversion is the thing that enabled her to like self-actualize and to achieve her freedom. Without inversion, she not only would she not have seen that symbolic gesture, but she interacts with different versions of Sator at different times. And their relationship in those scenes is different depending on what he just experienced and what she just experienced. We could talk about the characters a lot.
We could.
But clearly we disagree. You at least have to be down with the action, though. Like, the action in this movie
kicks ass.
It's super fucking good.
It's undeniable. immediately when you said action, I didn't start thinking about a fight scene. I started thinking about the bungee jumping into the reverse bungee jump.
Yeah.
Which is not a function of inversion technology. Yeah. They just run up the side of a building with the aid of bungee ropes.
Yeah.
And it kicks ass. And then they land on their respective balconies and take out the guys.
Yeah.
And the reveal that the dude that he's got on his knees with a gun to his head is not the arms dealer, that it's Priya, who gives also an amazing performance.
So Priya, played by iconic Indian actress Dimple Kapadia, becomes the protagonist, like boss, like the woman who gives him missions.
Exposition dump.
There is a lot of the exposition dump.
There's so much, and it's so irritating, and it's the thing about Nolan that bothers me the most.
You know what I find interesting with this one? So, like, all right, so Inception and Interstellar are, like, his two previous, like, original script sci-fi movies that are also buried in fucking exposition all the time, right? Those movies are always explaining to you the sci-fi mechanic of either what is currently happening or what is about to happen, so you can understand what you're about to watch, right?
I see where you're going with this. This
movie's weird step to the left that he takes here, because I was really hoping after Dunkirk, why I was so excited for this movie is like, oh man, like that dude grew up and now my boy who made Dunkirk and like shook off all of his like lazy bag of tricks where like Chris Nolan screenwriter doesn't trust Chris Nolan director to tell the story visually.
Right.
And then it comes out and it's still you're drowning in exposition, but the exposition is all about the like spy plot.
Yeah.
You're not really buried in exposition about the inversion mechanics. You get a little bit here and there, but mostly when you get those like wall-to-wall scenes that YouTube video that we'll have to share on the socials that I've said to so many people recently. When you get to those classic Chris Nolan scenes where you have like two smart people sitting in the room and one of them has to say a bunch of things to explain the plot to the other guy, and then the other guy asks questions, but then the answer that you get is to a different question, and they're constantly one-upping each other in terms of how smart they are. All of those scenes are about the plot. Who did what when a little bit, but not like how the mechanics of it work.
And I do very much appreciate that. And for all the convolutedness of time travel, just generally, I think this approach is pretty damn good and pretty well expressed.
It's,
I think the mechanic is
well impressed.
Fundamentally easier to understand than like the effect of time travel on the world is easier to understand when a person is taking up physical space going backwards.
Right. It's not like a portal that somebody
exactly
steps through.
And then you have to contend with like, where is that person at that particular time? Do they disappear? Do they not? No, they never disappear. They are always in physical space. You can track them. And visually Nolan does a good job of showing you where everybody is.
Yeah.
Like there was the moment when I thought that was going to break down was at Oslo, the second time that we're there.
Yeah.
We're waiting for Arpats and Debicki to come out of the turnstile. I was already doing the like, okay, what if they miss each other because time, because I've seen enough like annoying time travel shit. But no, they exist in the world, whether they're moving backwards or forwards. Yeah. So they're not going to miss each other.
There's a really good behind the scenes doc on the Blu-ray. So they brought on their lead visual effects supervisor pretty early to help do animatics for the movie, like to do like a it's not animatics.
Previs?
To previs it. They brought him in to do a complete previs of the movie, not in a Marvel way where they will previs a whole action scene shot for shot, and then basically just like the second unit goes and shoots that, but in a way where it's like, oh, we need to understand literally what is happening and where everybody is. The previs was basically like a very simple, textureless, color-coded 3D model of each of the sets or each of the major set pieces. Here's the Freeport turnstile, and here's Neil and the protagonist going in. And then we can see in real time the other ones, what they're doing outside. Because it's all happening, right?
Right.
Like, it's not like when you watch the turnstile fight or the Freeport Oslo fight the first time that Neil and the protagonist and or future Neil and future protagonist and future Wounded Cat aren't out there. Like, they're out there while the plane is crashing into the thing, right? They had one guy on the visual effects team who was on set all the time, and his job was to be the arbiter of what happened, because he had studied the 3D mockups and animatics they'd done so many times that if there was ever a question of like, wait, while this is happening, who is here, or does this punch happen before this, he was still always wrong, because nobody could wrap their brains around how to make this fucking movie. The fight between the two protagonists in the Freeport was the first week of shooting. And they all said it was like slamming their heads into the wall because they just couldn't wrap their fucking brains around it.
Probably a bad scene to pick as your first scene to
shoot. No, but
shoot.
But it's great because it's self-contained. It's on a set. It's not out on location. It's just two guys fighting. It is the simplest version of like all the inversion stuff that they would have to do. By the way, that scene, they had to shoot it 4 times. And I don't mean 4 takes and 4 angles. I mean, they shot it
the whole
all
thing.
The way through
yeah.
the protagonist in the suit who is entering the Freeport, right? You have to shoot it him. And then there's also the inverted protagonist in the SWAT gear. So you have to shoot that fight. And then you have to shoot it again from the point of view of the protagonist in the SWAT gear who is inverted, entering in, and then reversing the fight the whole way back. Plus, you have a protagonist who is running away from Neil as well,
yep.
which we see forwards and backwards. They finally figure out how to do all of it, and they just basically everything that they shot got more and more complicated because when they started making the movie, they didn't know how to do the end battle. And they're like, we'll put it at the end of the schedule. The shoot will last 6 months. Hopefully in 6 months, we'll figure out how to do this. Jamie, for the car chase, they took the drivetrains of any inverted car, took them apart, and rebuilt them backwards so that those cars could get up to top speed in reverse.
Right.
And then they had like a world-class team of stunt drivers, including Pattinson. The stunt drivers loved him and said he can totally do it. So he did a lot of his own driving the freeway chase.
That's super fucking
The freeway
cool.
chase is outstanding, and I still don't understand what happens in it.
It gets pretty confusing.
Which is a feature. For me, it's a feature and not a bug.
I'm not bothered by that.
I love it.
I'm bothered by paper-thin characters. I'm bothered by loads and loads of exposition. I just fundamentally don't have any fun watching the movie. Yeah, it's just like everything he does, I don't like. And I do appreciate and love that he's doing things that are not the cookie-cutter Marvel bullshit that you and I have both, like, been annoyed by.
Yeah, which I will still lap up most of it eagerly, hoping that there will be a morsel of, like, nutrition in there once
And I
in a
have
while.
Just completely divorced myself from it, and I'll watch the ones that Scott says are kind of okay.
You said something off mic when we talked last week about it, where you said that the movie feels... You didn't say pretentious, but you said it feels...
Condescending.
Condescending.
Is the word I used.
The other thing that you said is that it feels self-important.
Yes.
And I would like you to expand upon that, because I think that's interesting, and that's something I've previously said about Nolan's movies, and I'm curious what that means to you.
Okay. So I would like to preface this by saying that my opinion has mostly changed on my second viewing. I don't think that it feels self-important. I assigned it self-importance because I have felt that... from all of the Dark Knight movies and Inception. I don't know if it would still be there, if that impression would still be there if I went back and watched those movies also. But the feeling that I got from those movies and my first viewing of this movie was a tone of voice from the actors, a tone in the words of the script and in the dramatic use of sound and music that what people are saying or what is happening on screen is of dire importance, not just for them, but also for the viewer.
Yeah. And that can feel pretentious to people who don't find that there's any substance to it.
Right. I don't feel that there's much substance, but I also that impression, I feel like I understand the language of the film a little bit more, the language of Nolan a little bit more. And he's not going for that. I just think that's how he talks, essentially. That's how he make a movie. He's not trying to express self-importance. It's just this is how he communicates.
It's how he communicates, but it's also like it's his stylistic flourishes. It's his preferences. And also like he wants to make something that's very visceral and immersive. It does. It feels important, not important in a grand sense, but like there's a seriousness to it, right? His movies look serious. He has a very particular aesthetic that crosses over between the two DPs that he's worked with. There is a weightiness to the visuals. Like it looks like what serious movies look like, right?
Which is another thing that I don't like it when people or things take themselves too seriously really at all.
Yeah.
I prefer to live my life and enjoy things that have a bit of levity about who and what they are.
Right.
It doesn't ever feel at any moment like this movie could make a joke about itself.
No. No, God, no. Not at all.
And
you wouldn't want it to because the joke wouldn't be funny. Because there's never been a funny joke in a Christopher Nolan movie ever. There have been funny performances, but there have never been jokes that have landed in one of his movies ever.
And here we are back at like, we're in Jamie like,
right.
Does not like these things.
Yeah.
I like funny things. I like, even when it's serious, I want it to have a moment where it's like, okay, everybody breathe. Everybody remember that this is not cataclysmic. And even if it is cataclysmic,
yeah,
we can have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, that's just not his way. Can I tell you more fascinating things about the making of this movie? This is what Christopher Nolan said to the stunt coordinator when they had their first meeting. And he was like, here's how I think you should come up with the fight scenes. So first, you have two guys and you choreograph a fight and you have them fight and you film it. Then you have one of those guys take that tape and memorize just his part of it. Then you film him pantomiming the entire fight by himself with no one else there. Then you reverse that footage, show it to him and to the guy that he's fighting, and they both memorize the fight backwards now. Then you film that, and then you play that backwards in the movie. And that's where the stunt coordinator's brain just, like, melted out of his head. Like, that it is as intuitive as it is to understand literally what is happening in the movie, which is not always very intuitive.
Yeah.
But, like, that it is as intuitive as it is, like, an enormous testament to the integrity and how thoughtful everybody was in making a very silly, paper-thin James Bond time travel movie. Like, can you imagine
That's the thing. If it were very silly, I would be on board. It's
but
not.
It doesn't feel silly.
It's not
but
silly.
But it is silly. It is kind of a silly
It
movie
is kind of silly, but it doesn't feel silly. If it felt silly, I would be screaming from the rooftops about how much I love this movie. If there was an element of, we've been over this.
Yeah.
I'm just
Jamie, I have a recommendation for you.
What's
if
that?
You would like a movie that has lots of terrific action and time travel shenanigans that are rooted in character and rooted in thematics and that is a lot of fun to watch and is at times silly and has fun at the expense of time travel.
Yes.
I recommend a little 2019 motion picture for you called Avengers Endgame.
Oh, Jesus.
Because what you're asking for is Avengers Endgame.
All right. I'm going to watch Avengers Endgame.
Well, but you have to watch Avengers Infinity War as well. And there's probably like 6 or 7 other movies you should watch before you watch those. I'm just going to get Jamie to watch all the Marvel movies, guys.
Just so you all know, for the listening public, my brains are now leaking out of my ears because
yeah.
I just want to watch one of these movies.
Well, but you can't just watch that one. Like,
okay, well, then I'm not watching any of them.
Okay, fine.
Can we talk about wine? Or do you have more things to say about movie?
Well, you didn't think this movie was lush.
No,
which I find very confounding because I think it's lush. You know what's lush to me in this movie is John David Washington in that like fitted perfect polo driving a speedboat off the Amalfi Coast or something, wherever the hell they're stationed, taking, you know, immaculately dolled up Elizabeth Debicki back to like Kenneth Branagh's mega super yacht. And we just like hang out with him. That's lush. The insane, bonkers, fucking like,
but it's so
steel.
Gray.
It's not gray. It's actually got. I wouldn't say it's a very saturated color palette,
it's
but like,
not.
But it's not gray. It's not a gray movie. It's not a Russo Brothers Marvel movie, which are pretty fucking gray sometimes.
It's not particularly colorful, which is one of the things when I think of the word lush.
What about the water? The water is a lush blue. That like golden sunlight reflecting off the two of them. Jamie, his maroon suit.
The maroon
His
suit.
His maroon suit
I'll give you
and
the maroon
polo. All of her dresses.
The polo is gray.
He wears several polos.
He looks great.
He looks great.
I mean, and all, like, how could that man not look great?
He's a very, very...
Super, super
Very
hot.
Handsome, charismatic man. But it's lush. I think it's lush for sure.
The thing for me that keeps it feeling austere as opposed to lush is all of the dialogue being fucking about plot.
Yeah.
That's not lush. This is utilitarian. The sounds that I'm hearing, and not just the dialogue, but also the fucking music is like clanging, fucking obnoxious.
The score rules. You don't like the score?
I liked it a lot more when I had it at a reasonable volume with the subtitles on.
No, you didn't!
I did.
Guys, I forbid Jamie from watching this movie with subtitles.
And I liked it more with the subtitles because struggling to understand what a person is saying is a fundamental fucking flaw. I'm sorry, let me take that again so that I don't peek. It's a fundamental fucking flaw.
That was pretty good. Okay, so here is how I feel about the dialogue issue. And for anyone who mysteriously like hasn't seen the movie yet, if you remember in Dark Knight Rises, where Tom Hardy as Bane, in addition to having a ridiculous and whimsical accent, I'm just realizing now, He also has this absurd fucking, like, skull mouth breathing apparatus over his mouth, and all of his dialogue, they re-recorded, it still sounds muffled as shit, like the microphone is inside. It's like,
yeah. You can barely understand what the fuck he's saying.
This whole movie, this is what I warned you about ahead of time, that like inverted people can't breathe non-inverted air, so they have to wear breathing masks over their mouths. And so, like for the back half of the movie, you can't understand a very large portion of the dialogue.
When I said earlier that that was a fundamental fucking problem, I don't know that I can overstate that. Like that is an unforgivable flaw.
Oh, I think it's forgivable. Jamie, you can't at one time complain that all of the dialogue is plot and utilitarian and not lush
and then
not
complain
human,
that I can't
and
understand
then complain
it?
That you can't
absolutely
hear it.
I can. Are you kidding me? Absolutely I can. I can complain about those two things simultaneously because if they're talking, then I should be able to understand them, unless it is deliberate that I am not supposed to hear them.
I think that's what it is.
Well, then why the fuck
are they
is
speaking?
There a closed caption that actually tells me, like,
that,
there
that
are,
I agree with.
There are points in the movie that it says muffled talking.
Yes.
And
I
then,
think half the subtitle should be like that.
But then why are they talking? It's
so,
just annoying and
it is annoying.
It makes you strain and it
yes.
takes you out of what is going on.
Does it?
Yes.
Or does it put you more into
no,
what's going on?
No, it takes
on?
You out
Let me,
of what
so
is going
this
on.
Is what Richard King, who is Nolan's like go-to sound designer, including for this movie, he did an AMA last July in response to a question about how dialogue is increasingly inaudible. What he said was, Chris is trying to create a visceral, emotional experience for the audience beyond merely an intellectual one. Like punk rock music, it's a full-body experience, and dialogue is only one facet of the sonic palette. He wants to grab the audience by the lapels and pull them toward the screen and not allow the watching of his films to be a passive experience. If you can, my advice would be to let go of any preconceptions of what is appropriate and right and experience the film as it is, because a lot of hard, intentional thought and work has gone into the mix. So on the one hand, I agree with this. Like, look, if you saw this movie and you didn't trust the theater, like, I might have even gone out and complained to the management. Like, your center channel is fucked, and I'm not hearing half the dialogue, right? But, like, knowing Nolan and knowing how precise he is and hearing the movie, like, in my own theater that, like, I know that everything is correct and having all of these other accounts to back it up, I feel that it was presented to you correctly. It was presented to me correctly. And I respect that the artist makes that choice, and I see that there's an effect to it. The effect is subjectivity. You're having trouble hearing the dialogue because it's in the heat of the moment and it's in battle and he wants things to be real and he wants that viscerality to it. And I think for him, it's more important that you feel like it's all happening and that you're in the moment than it is that you understand the dialogue. I understand that. I also think it's kind of annoying and it used to bother the hell out of me. I think it's just another one of his like weird things that for most other filmmakers would be a bug. I'm not necessarily going to move it into the feature category, but I accept it as part of the package, and I think it's part of like the sonic experience of his movies.
I want to say a thing. I want to say a thing about specifically this, and then I hope that we can move on.
And then I think
wine.
We can talk about wine after this,
because my brain is melting out of my skull. But that whole quote that you just read,
yeah.
about him wanting to have an immersive experience that
yeah.
takes you by the lapels,
yeah,
that being the object,
yeah.
then why are we so fucking dependent on dialogue in other places of the movie to communicate everything? I think that maybe it's true, not maybe, obviously it's true that this is intentional, but it flies directly in the face of another thing that he's doing. These things are not congruent, nor are they compatible, and having them both in the same movie makes me have to speak essentially two different languages to understand the movie.
That's interesting.
Because I'm here... In the whole first three quarters of the movie, I'm dependent, I'm hanging on every word that
yeah.
is said. And then suddenly I can't understand
yeah.
the words that are being said.
Did you glean any narrative or character clarity from the dialogue that was obscured? Was there important information that you gained watching it with the subs the second time?
It mostly set me at ease.
That's interesting. Because my guess would be that there's not any important dialogue that you're losing out on in the muffling.
What having the words there does is allow me to actually engage rather than strain to hear this fucking dialogue. And I guess your argument here is take it as it is.
Yeah.
Don't strain to hear it, except that
right.
you're not supposed to hear it. But now we're back to now I have to have two different languages to unlock this fucking movie.
I don't think it's that you have to have two different languages, because it's not like the movie has some dialogue in the action scenes where people are wearing masks where it's clear for you to hear it, and then other dialogue isn't muffled. Like, he's not having his cake and eating it, too. Like, the dialogue is very clear when there's not car chases and fucking turbines and, oh, by the way, with the turbines, the 747 that they crashed into the airport. How do you think that they did that? I'll just tell you, they got a real 747.
And crashed it.
And then they crashed it into a real building.
Which is fantastic.
Because fucking why not?
I love that.
It's outstanding.
I absolutely love that.
It looks so good. I don't think you're wrong, but like you said, like, why is the dialogue there? Like, I should be engaging with it, and the muffled audio is making it harder for you to engage. Well, maybe the point is that you should engage with something else.
It's bad at communicating that, though. The dialogue isn't muffled in a way that communicates to me that I'm not supposed to understand it.
Right, because they keep talking, and they understand each other. I do not disagree with you. I mean, like, I do, but I can't say that you're wrong. It's one of the things about him that just makes me laugh. I was like, oh, Chris Nolan, you silly boy. You get Warner Brothers to give you $200 million to make you a movie, and your star isn't really a star, and nobody knows what the fuck this is about. And then you're not even going to let audiences listen to all of your exposition. What a weirdo. Like, I don't know, man. I just shrug my shoulders at it. Like, it's part and parcel.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, Jamie again. We hope you enjoyed part one of our episode about Christopher Nolan's Tenet, paired with Val D'Espino's Inocente, Fino Sherry. We had a really great discussion and ran pretty long. We cut it basically right down the middle. Next week, we'll drop our takes on the wine and the pairing. Thanks for joining us. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe, and follow. We crave validation. We're on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Contact us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com with any inquiries. Remember that we'll be back in just 1 week rather than our usual two with the second part of this discussion. And as always, remember to watch more movies and drink more wine. It's good for you. We promise.